Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Rachel Mennies. Rachel Mennies' first book, The Glad Hand of God Points Backwards, won the Walt MacDonald First Book Prize from Texas Tech University Press and will be published in April of 2014. Her poems have appeared in Hayden's Ferry Review, Poet Lore, Black Warrior Review, Cimarron Review, and elsewhere, and have been reprinted at Poetry Daily. Born in the Philadelphia area, she currently lives in Pittsburgh and teaches at Carnegie Mellon University. Hi, Rachel. How are you?
Hi. I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. It's great to have you, and I want to congratulate you on your book.
Oh, thank you. It's very exciting.
It really is. That's a great press, and so you're all finished with that and just waiting for it.
Yeah, just waiting for it to arrive, and we're in the process now of looking at art and finalizing sort of what happens next. It's been a really great process.
So. Yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'd like to hear some poems.
Sure. I'm going to open with a few that open the book. It come from the first half of the book. This one's called How to Make Yourself Remembered. Bury the trinkets first, candlesticks or a favorite paring knife. The silver, but not the gold. If your story has a dog, bury her bone. In her next life, she'll return as a woman, find herself traveling through Germany, riveted to a patch of ground in the former West Berlin. Bury the fragile in a shallow grave, the cotton skirts, the soft paper, the white linens for the Sabbath. Your excavator should pull your relics whole from an earth still kind to its company. Bury household objects to purposefully perplex an excavator, a diaphragm, or an unmarked teaspoon. That way, when they reconstruct your story, the little rubber disc will live forever, an alien saucer with pins to anchor it in an American history museum. The spoon will cradle a weight unasked of it before. Matriarch. Sarah had Rebecca, had Leah and Rachel, had precedent, had sand, had order, had opposition, had energy, had mourning, had parchment and ink, had commentary, had liturgy, had fire, had goats for the altar, had the longest dresses and the longest skirts, had offspring, had offspring, had offspring, had no use for sarcasm, but lived thick with God's ironies, had the text of all stories to read to their children at nightfall, had the maps of every city quartered to keep them faithful, had the blessings of a creature more powerful and impulsive, had the love of the men who have loved me or not loved me, had the hearts of the bodies we stand on tall as arcs, had the shawl to wrap around my bare and sloping shoulders, had the soil to force into my fists and turn my body west. This next poem, what happens, I've seen in my family, when you try to tell the story of a family that suffered trauma. My grandmother and great-grandmother and great-aunts escaped the Nazis in the 1930s, and a good portion of the first book is trying to approximate telling their story. Their story has mythology, commentary, a lot of misremembering mixed in with what I guess we would call the truth of what happened. And I do some work in this book to try to show the seams of that, show the tension, not just try to get it right, but show how we sort of learned what happened through all of that family mess and the larger mess of history. So this poem sort of plays with some of that real versus magical versus traumatic kind of tension. This is called The Creation of Temple Beth Shalom. And this is a temple near where I grew up. So it's still there and still looks like this. The Creation of Temple Beth Shalom. Frank Lloyd Wright had built most of his legacy, and it was good. Falling Water tumbled over itself in Pittsburgh. The Guggenheim perched on the Upper East Side. Then the Lord appeared to him as he lay in bed one night. The Lord said unto Wright, "Bring your pens and your drafting paper to Philadelphia, where you shall build a new house of worship for the Jews." Wright, Midwest Baptist minister's son, sat up straight in bed. "The Jews?" he asked, then pointed a finger at the ceiling. "What do you think my art can bring to the Jews?" The Lord said unto Wright, "Between you and me, I've been a bad father lately. And thus Beth Shalom, mountain of glass, giant winged ark, came to land on Old York Road, the last building Wright designed before his death, forever stuck in self-reflection, the panes making walls and roof of sky. Story from another Inquisition. Deborah wasn't a Jew, and then she is. One day, the salt from locks, so flushed, so red, no longer cloys, but hearkens to a parted sea, a mat of smoke and ocean on the tongue. Or maybe a relative in Argentina picks up the phone, calls Deborah, speaks the Barhu slowly, the Hebrew filling her ears, unlocking like a door. This relative, a quiet old refugee Jew, speaks Spanish to his mailman, but whispers, "I love you," to his wife in Polish each night before bed, the candlesticks kept polished in the closet, a habit of secrets. Maybe Deborah's always been good at keeping her own secrets, the clarinet that makes her weep, street corner klezmer, the melody she knew before she came into existence. She's always felt old, so old, older than all the graves of Europe, older than Eve, who, like all Jews, had to learn the truth at the sight of her hungry mouth.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Rachel Menes. And she's reading from her new book, The Glad Hand of God Points Backwards, which will be released from Texas Tech University Press this April. Rachel, I'm really interested in what you were starting to talk about related to misremembering and truth and as a strategy in the poems to show the seams and show the tension. Did you come to that after at first trying to remember things or trying to record some historical facts, et cetera?
Yeah, I think I started writing this book as a memoir in a graduate writing class, and it wasn't working. I mean, part of that could be that I'm a poet, and the straight lines of memoir just were not my straight lines. But I also found that trying to get the truth that someone could sign off on from my family was not possible in about this particular part of our history. And part of that is that my grandmother, who is the oldest of three girls, just like me and my sisters. She was 11. She's the oldest of the three when she came over. So her understanding of what happened and her memories are all child's memories. And to understand the true dark depth of what happened in Berlin to my family in the 1930s as a young child, in some ways I think those memories are more authentic because she didn't have the adult understanding. But they aren't textbook, type them up in a history book. Sometimes she says it wasn't so bad and things were fine, and then some of her stories really strike me as the opposite of that. We know that my great-grandfather's business was destroyed on Kristallnacht, and we know that my grandmother's school was destroyed, but her memories are vary from, oh, coming over, everything was fine and sunny, to something a bit more complicated. And it wasn't until I was an adult that I had a real appreciation for how difficult that must have been. And putting that against growing up Jewish without a discussion of that, because my grandmother doesn't like to talk about it as much or needed to be solicited to talk about it, I felt that it was working more to write it as I learned it than to try to parse out the truth. I think one good example of that, I made it to Germany when I was in college and was looking for, we had the address of my grandmother, my great-grandmother, where they grew up. And we looked over and over, and what we ended up finding at that address was a brand new apartment complex. And I thought, well, of course, that to think I would find this perfectly preserved memory exactly as my grandmother had described this building, that's what I was looking for. And I think that's when it sort of hit me. Well, history has moved on. History has changed. And Germany was leveled. Berlin was leveled. So the idea that I would find things as she remembered them to still be true just wasn't working. So I thought at that point, okay, this book needs to happen on different terms. So
right, okay. Could you read some more poems?
Yeah, absolutely. These next four poems come from a later part of the book, and the second half of the book really wrestles with coming of age as a Jewish woman, as a sort of burgeoning feminist in a very patriarchal religion. And this first poem I'm going to read, the Amidah, is a prayer, the prayer to the patriarchs that My Reform Synagogue sort of tacked on at the end. You said, oh, by the way, here are the names of the matriarchs, a sort of a proto-feminist kind of move. But even when I was younger hearing that, I thought, I don't know if that's enough. If you listen to the prayer, it really doesn't solve the problem. So throughout there are some lines from the translated lines from the prayer in here. It's called Amidah for Teenage Girls. We said it Friday nights in unison. Blessed is Abraham, Isaac, patriarchs whose weight we felt against our chests. Jacob, whose brother filled his mouth with the sand of hate, who split sisters with his body of patience. The God of history, reads the Siddur, nothing more dangerous than this sort of God. Any good girl will tell you so. Ask Leah, who watched as her betrothed tilled fields in agony, rutted at her nightly, his pious bride, as he dreamed for 7 years of younger Rachel's face. God, our brute teacher, God, whom we thank and thank for these big men. You are mighty forever, my Lord. You resurrect the dead. My Lord, open my lips that my mouth may declare your praise. Imagine the shock, that first boy or man inside us for mere seconds, the tremor of realization, some smaller God at our clavicle, thrumming in awareness, the creator of all things. And so when I lie with him, my body already knows what to do while he shifts his weight, moves his hips. You cause the wind to blow and the rain to fall, the hard ram's horn, the arms thrust high, parting a sea of salt. O King, helper, savior, and shield. And what of our pleasure, that quiet subtext, that patient search against our partner's sweaty brows near to finished? We already know the phrase, bestow, bestow. Like the Amidah, this poem looks at a part of my sort of liturgical upbringing. And the Song of Solomon is this beautiful poem in the middle towards the end of the Torah. It's this lush, sexual, very sparkling love poem from a groom to his new bride. And I remember learning to read from the Torah, and you're twisting the scroll, and it's just block after block, like these bricks of Hebrew prose. And then you come to Solomon, and it just opens up. It's lineated. And I think learning about, reading that poem, seeing that as a young woman, and that was a moment when I think I started to realize that I was interested in poetry. I'd thought of myself as a writer, but I just was so struck by the beauty of the setup of the Song of Solomon, and then was sort of taken in later by the poem itself. So this poem is called Solomon, after that prayer. Solomon. As children, my sister and I dressed as brides. The gown in the basement came from anywhere, hand-me-down, touched any body before ours. We'd line up in our bedroom, preen and bat our eyes, say, I do, I will. We married each sort of imaginary man. We gave these suitors no gifts, took turns with them. This one carries the mail. This one lives in the biggest building in Philadelphia. This one knows all the words to back in the USSR. Her turn, then mine, to watch the other wed, covered in the found jewels of our family, dust rising with each breath inside the ivory. This one will be Jewish, my chance at the altar, veil just pinned. What other kind of man is there? She asked me, covering my face. First Gentile. I promise him bitterness, salt, the tastes of all my dead, gold and wax, the roots of trees. Against me he is scaffolding, linen, bicep and thigh, all newness, private liturgy of high school hunger, snow collecting on his parents' car. I've just observed Hanukkah, the consecrated fuel that burned on faith, young enough to believe in the miracle that's mine alone. A forsaken fuse and the hands that light it, the labor of soldiers and battle and cold, then the flame. He finds me in handfuls, first hair, then skin, then cries, then silence, his torso reclothed, tying his sneakers. You'd be better at this, he says, at touching so quickly, efficient and practiced, if you stopped thinking so much. But I have the worries of my great aunts, their consonant names. After he leaves, the snow melts to puddles. The engine of my mouth runs on the fumes of God. This is the last poem in the book. The Jewish woman remembers Deuteronomy 6:6-9. We cry for God in worship, later in bed, witness to the power of giving up our power. outside, the wind crying for God, outside, in the fit of rain, a God just forming. Our bodies, naked before men, are God, as sure as the force that pushes men toward and toward us. What they search for is a noise in the earth, like God growing crops, still saving room enough for the cemeteries. The lungs expand with our God, God in the scream, also the moan, in the splitting of wood and the spilling of blood, the slaughtered bull and the dismounted horse. God of the summoning, curling finger, the broken limb and its setting right. God in the remembering and the forgetting, the sheepskin paper and the pulp. The words we can recite, they're loosening as we walk to our end. God that keeps our eyes reading. God in the hands that close the book, remove the spectacles and turn off the light. God in our night, which never can stay night.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Rachel Menes. And Rachel's book, The Glad Hand of God, Points Backwards, won the Walt MacDonald First Book Prize from Texas Tech University Press, and it will be published in April of 2014, which is really exciting. you know, when I listen to your poems, which are terrific, I keep feeling this, you know, obviously a great voice in there, but I feel a sense of order and clarity there. And I wonder if you could talk about that as is that something that you drive for in your work? Or, you know, I know that you have maybe not a love, but a like of form in poetry. Can you talk about that idea of order?
Yeah, I've always liked... I'm very much a poet who revises all the time, and my poems don't start in a place of order. I think they start in a blurt, and part of learning to be a better writer was learning to make something of that blurt and not always know that the first line is the line that will stay. I like form because I think it allows you to push against order while you're enacting that order. I think about a quarter of the poems in this book are sonnets in one way or another. I love the sonnet because it asks you to make this shift towards something new or shocking or unexpected, and it's a requirement not just of the argument of the poem, but of the form, that there is a spot in there. I think form does allow you to take some more risks. I know when I taught creative writing, my students hated form because they thought it was harder. It's easier just to blurt. And I like the order imposed on the chaos of that, and then what it sort of asks of you. It asks of you to follow a tradition, but then also push against it at the same time. And I think there's a lot of embracing and pushing against from a sort of experience perspective in this book as well, understanding what it means to still identify as Jewish and not practice, or identify as Jewish and be married to somebody who's not Jewish, or identify as Jewish and understand what that means to my family, to my grandmother, in the context of what they've been through and what she's been through. So I think order has a sort of seductive appeal, but also makes me want to sort of see what I can do against that as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I always want to bring up organic form and the form that is inherent in free verse, and mm-hmm. that there's ways to also push against that, maybe not as obviously. And I'm not saying you're obviously pushing against something, but mm-hmm. do you know what I'm saying?
That
So I always feel that whenever talking about form, I always feel that the form and the push to have a major turn in a free verse poem also, but which is less prescribed, as in when and how.
Yeah, that's hard. Most of the book is in free verse, but I think for me they're some of the hardest poems to write and the most wonderful when they're realized, because you're right, it does happen organically. And two, sometimes finding that you are working in a form that you've made up yourself in a weird way. That can always be a fun discovery when you realize, oh, this does have a sort of operating principle, and it just happened. I didn't find it in a textbook or from my poetry professor or something
right,
like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Could you read some more?
Yeah. I brought with me some poems from a new manuscript that I've been working on in the interim, as the book was sort of floating around the world looking for a home, and in the time since the last 8 months or so since it's been realized as a project with Texas Tech. And these, the first two poems I'm going to read, part of the book focuses on Greek myth and also the country. I went to Greece this summer, and the oldness there. I've been writing still a lot about God and ideas of God, and Greece presents some really interesting challenges with that, having a whole host of gods up on the mountain that you can go to the mountain and see, here's the mountain where the gods live. And so these first two poems are, one takes place in Pittsburgh and one takes place in Crete. The first one is Echo and Narcissus, Pittsburgh. Narcissist, she sees omens everywhere. It makes it possible for her to believe in God, in her marriage, rippling beside her in the Mon. She counts each cardinal in the trees, each green light stacked one after the other on Fifth Avenue. The world wrapped around her like a thicket, like a cave. But the gods built the cardinals, each tree, each of these three rivers. And some nights, while her husband sleeps, she hears the echo pulsing through the East End like a siren only her God-made ears can hear. Lean over me, one bank at a time, and see how you can make this last forever. Now lean farther, lean farther.
Did you actually have a half rhyme in there with God and Mon? Did
you do that? I guess it kind of happened. Yeah, they're both at the end of the line too. So, yeah.
I've never heard that in my life. That's great.
God in a Pittsburgh river. It makes sense in its way. Yeah, and then this one goes all the way halfway across the world. So where the man gets dinner, Heraclio, Crete. Ask the men to take you to the kitchen. And tourist, they will take you to the kitchen, run their fingers along the slits in the gutted fish, show you the work your otherness has earned you. I choose the fish with radiant skin, the red, dappled and neon, sheen like our Maine lobster after death. Home, when a loved one dies, we go to the deli, buy the salmon already smoked, the casket closed, always closed, none of the body's damning work to see. Here we must eat the eyes with open eyes, the head sucked, sweet, and severed to oblivion. This poem is called Anatomy. I've been learning a bit about the medical world through my husband, who's just starting out his life as a physician, and it is a strange and wonderful world, one that I'm sort of confronting with great awe and some complications. That's sort of what this poem is looking at. It's called Anatomy. Today I let a man hold me whose hands had been inside the dead. We make a habit of this, touching after anatomy lecture, after convocation with the cadavers, the basement of fumes and rubbery cold muscle. Together we reclaim the twin virtues of pulse and breath. We raise them and lower them at will, like scientists. At the table, softness and roughness yield the same indifference from the dead. This is mortality, a one-way valve, to commit surgeries and later need a body in motion, something like the man's own body, motor and joint, hinge and open mouth. So warm, he says, and marvels, though I'm as hot or cold as any other creature who could still touch him back. Daughter. I see the moment when she first fails, shame or fear, like a match she lit and gripped and didn't blow. And woman, she will foster this failure and tend to it like appetite. I know she will seek me and say, Mother, I made a mistake. And suddenly I find myself at the oak kitchen table with my own mother, who weeps and says, My daughter, if you someday have a daughter. And then she stops and stands, and I know she cannot say, it is awful living this life all over again in your body of mine.
Rachel, can you talk about the choice, or maybe it happened organically, I don't know, that choice to, there's a lot of God in the poems, as mm-hmm. in the title.
Yeah. You know?
The Glad Hand of God Points Backwards, which I think is a great title. But there's a lot of a repetition of God, 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 God.
Mm-hmm, yeah. God everywhere, yeah.
and also, you know, you're quoting the Torah, and there's a lot of engagement with the idea of God. Were you ever worried that that might, like, affect your readers or, you know, shut some people out, or have, even though it stopped them from getting in to see what you were doing with it.
Yeah, that was a huge concern for me with the first manuscript, with The Glad Hand of God, because it's, I didn't want it to be a book that, I used to work at Barnes & Noble back when I was in high school, and there is that spirituality section. Yeah. And what I'm thinking of there is like the chicken soup sort of like glowing, always positive look at God. And that is not what the book does. But I didn't want people to approach it as a religious book or religious book of poetry. I'm not even sure if I believe in God or what kind of God I believe in. And I was shocked when this book finished and I read back. And I mean, like you said, that God is all over this book and even coming up in some of my new poems. I think part of it comes from growing up in a very religious tradition and coming to terms with that. And as an adult, I wonder if I'm thinking of other Jewish writers, Maxine Kuman in particular, Robin Becker.
Alicia Ostreicher.
Yes.
Who writes about God quite a bit.
Yeah, who do so from a perspective that is complicated and that looks at, I guess what I would call sort of the damages and the blessings together in context with history. And I think that The Glad Hand does some of that work, too. The new poems just have still surprised me. I thought I wrote my way out of God, and now he's coming back, or yeah, whoever, he, think, she, many of them all together on Mount Olympus, whatever it is, they won't go away. I don't know why.
There's a lot more coming. But we have time, I think, for one more, maybe.
Yeah. I will end with, so I mentioned before when I said I'd been to Germany, I was actually living in Spain, and I spent some time living in Spain, and being a Jewish American woman in a Catholic country that the folks that have lived there are, that are Spanish, have been Spanish for millennia. I was sort of a strange creature to the, I lived with a Spanish family. So I'll read a poem about that experience. These are a couple of small pieces from a long poem called Huevos for Seder. At home, we'd pray for a good supper, then set an extra place at the table for a stranger, the perfect guest. Our Savior surely would never eat his eggs raw, not like Madre, who drinks superstitiously from the shell, breaks them open with her bare hands, looks hungrily at the runny life inside. 2. Map of Europe between us, Madre and I sit at her kitchen table. You are Jewish? She asks me. I'm American, I say. You are Jewish, she says. America, invention of the nomad, roof over the outcast's head. Then I'm German, I say. No, she tells me, kind in her surety. I am Spanish. You are Jewish. Thus, I learn about nationalism, that unscalable wall, that darkened, padlocked home. I inherit the menacing map entire. I live lost in each nation of sand. 3. In Toledo, the synagogues are all museums, stamped and tiled with the crescent and the cross, a reception hall for all of Abraham's children. Whoever had the biggest army got to pick the decorations. In Madrid, all Orthodox, they keep a cop outside. I slurp it raw, the Spanish huevo that lives on the shelf, somehow never spoils, just as Madre talked. Let the yolk break on your teeth. It spills like a prayer from my lips.
The poetry of Rachel Menes. Thank you so much. It was really good.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And I also want to mention one more time, Rachel Menes' book, The Glad Hand of God Points Backwards, will be released from Texas Tech University Press in April of 2014. You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.